Soon the sun was low in the western sky, and its red glare reflecting off the snow made the defenders squint. Preacher wondered for a moment if Swift Arrow might try and attack just as the sun went down, in hopes that the white men on the rise would be blinded. He didn't think the war chief would risk that, preferring to wait until dark when sneaking up on the wagons would be easier. But where engines were concerned, nothing could be ruled out. They usually did whatever they took a notion to, whether it made sense to a white man's way of thinking or not.
All right, anybody wants anything to eat or drink, or if you just want to stretch your legs, now's the time.
Angela and Jonathan came out from under the wagon. Angela went to check on Jeffrey and the children, while Jonathan got a dipper of water from one of the barrels. The water had ice crystals in it, but it hadn't frozen solid yet. Preacher went over to Nate.
How you doing, partner?
I'm all right. I'm scared, though, Preacher.
Yeah, so am I.
Really? I didn't think you ever got scared, Preacher.
Oh, sure. I've been scared plumb half to death plenty of times in my life. Like when I had to fight an old grizzly bear. Only a fool wouldn't be scared going up against an old grizz like that. Or hell, when we was at war with the British, and the outfit I was part of had to fight him in New Orleans. Yeah, that was mighty scary, too. I couldn't even begin to count the times I've been scared.
But you never quit. You never ran.
Well, when the good Lord was handing out things that fill up a man and make him what he is, he didn't see fit to put a whole lot of backup in me. It ain't something I do on purpose, you understand? It's just the way I am.
I wish I could be as brave.
You plan to keep them rifles loaded like I asked you?
Yeah, sure.
Well, if a fellow does what's gotta be did, no matter how scared he is, and he's just as brave as anybody else.
As brave as you mean?
Oh, I sure do.
Thanks, Preacher.
Oh my God! It's Peter! What's he doing?
Preacher wheeled around, feeling a flash of anger toward himself because he had let the conversation with Nate distract him. He hadn't been keeping an eye on the situation as well as he should have been. He hadn't noticed when Peter Galloway left the wagons. By now, Peter was 100 yards away, striding out into the valley, heading straight toward the Arikara war party. Preacher stared at Peter's retreating back, for a second unable to comprehend what the hell that man thought he was doing.
Galloway! Damn it, get back here! Galloway!
Peter ignored him and kept walking toward the engines.
Stop him! For God's sake, he's going to get himself killed!
Everybody stay here. Take your positions, be ready to fire.
God damn it! Stop, you stupid son of a bitch!
Preacher kept an eye on the distances involved. Peter wasn't in range of the war party's bows, but if he kept up that walk fast enough for much longer, he was gonna be.
Swift Arrow! Swift Arrow, can you hear me?
There was no response from the engines. Preacher knew they could hear Peter just fine.
Swift Arrow, I'm the one you want! I killed your brave back there near your village! Take me! Let the others go!
Preacher kept running after Peter, and finally Peter glanced back. Then he broke into a run.
God damn it!
I surrender! The others had nothing to do with it! Let them go and you can have me!
Damn fool didn't realize that the engines already had him. His surrender now wouldn't change a blessed thing. The war party wanted vengeance, not only for the young man Peter had murdered, but also for the warriors they had lost when they set out to even the score. Peter thought he was making a noble gesture, maybe in an attempt to redeem himself, at least partially in his wife's eyes. But in reality, all he was doing was throwing away his life and making the odds for everyone else even worse. An arrow shot through the air. It fell short, but Peter didn't stop.
Kill me! Kill me and let the others go!
Get away! Stop now! God damn it! They're gonna...
The next arrow slammed into Peter's chest. Peter stumbled, but stayed on his feet and kept running toward the engines.
Take me! Don't kill the others!
Two more arrows thudded into Peter, one in the chest, one in the belly. Peter staggered and twisted around. He looked back at Preacher, his eyes wide with pain and the realization that he was doomed. He saw Preacher back away, knowing that he was dangerously close to being in range himself.
Preacher! I'm sorry!
The arrow hit him in the back of the neck and penetrated all the way through so that the bloody arrowhead emerged from his throat. Preacher wheeled around and lit a shot for the wagons. He risked a glance over his shoulder and saw that the war party was giving chase. One of their most hated enemies had come close to him, almost in their grasp, and they hadn't been able to resist the temptation to come after him. A grim smile tugged at Preacher's mouth. This might work out after all, if it all depended on how fast he could run. It was a fantastic race with stakes of life and death there in the fading light. Preacher was 100 yards ahead of the Indians, but he had to cover almost 300 yards to reach the relative safety of the wagon. The snow hampered his progress a little, but his pursuers had to contend with the same obstacle. Preacher slowed down. He could have run faster, but he didn't want to now. If he drew away from them, they would realize they couldn't catch him and would turn back. He didn't want that. He wanted to pull them off, so he let them come closer and closer to him. He was about 100 yards away from the wagons when the defenders opened up. Two of the Rees went down. The others came on. They were slowing now that they realized Preacher had become the bait in the trap. Jonathan, Roger, and Angela had all the rifles loaded before they fired their first volley. That allowed them to fire again quickly. The Preacher stopped and whirled, throwing the hawk into his shoulder. Preacher pulled his right-hand pistol. Preacher started running again, and this time he didn't look back. With Nate's help, the defenders were reloading and firing as fast as they could. Preacher threw a look over his shoulder and saw that the Indians were retreating now, leaving their dead and wounded behind for the moment, although he was sure they would come back for him later. He counted six bodies on the ground, and he thought one or two more of the fleeing warriors were limping and staggering from their wounds. Peter's crazy notion had allowed the others to strike a heavy blow at the enemy, but they were still outnumbered by more than 2-1, and it would be dark soon. Swift Arrow wouldn't give up. He would still rush the wagons as soon as night had fallen.
We got some of them! I saw some of them go down!
Yeah, you sure did, Jonathan. I figured we'd done for 5 or 6 of them. There's a couple more wounded, maybe bad enough so they're out of the fight.
And Peter?
He never had a chance.
Angela crawled out from underneath the wagon in time to hear that. Roger went to her and put an arm around her shoulder to comfort her. Both of them had lost a spouse in the past couple of days. Even though Angela had come to despise Peter and had declared their marriage over, there had still been enough of a bond remaining between them so that she felt his loss. The sun was gone, and its light was beginning to fade from the sky. In less than an hour, Preacher thought, Swift Air and the rest of the Arikara war party would be coming. And one way or another, this would be the end of a long chase. While he had the chance, Preacher went to check on Jeffrey and the younger children.
What now?
Same as before. When the time comes, we find them as best we can.
Jeffrey nodded grimly. He sat on one of the bunks with 4 loaded pistols at his side. If it came down to it, Preacher was sure that Jeffrey would defend the youngins to his last breath. Preacher saw Nate coming toward him in the dusk.
Preacher, did I do all right?
As far as I can tell, you done just fine. You ready to do some more loading?
Yes, sir.
Well, it shouldn't be too long now.
Preacher went back to the first wagon and nodded to Roger, who stood there leaning on a rifle, the butt resting on the snowy ground.
That was terrible. I didn't know Peter had that much courage. It was a grand gesture.
Yeah. You got all the guns loaded?
Loaded and primed. All we have to do is cock and fire. But once it's dark, how will we know the Indians are attacking?
We're gonna have to let them make the first move. It's risky, but we don't have much choice.
So they take the first shot and we hope they miss?
Yeah, pretty much.
How many of them are there?
12, 14, somewhere along in there.
And there are 5 of us? More than 3-1 odds.
I've faced worse and come through all right.
Preacher, Angela is quite fond of you. You'll take care of her if you both live through this.
This ain't the time to be thinking about that.
And the children, someone will have to look after them.
Yeah, that'd be a good job for the two of you.
The two of... You mean Angela and me?
Y'all been through a lot together, and you both love them kids. Now, I ain't saying or meaning any more than that. I reckon right now you're thinking that you ain't got a thing to live for, Roger. I'm just saying maybe you do.
You're an odd man, Preacher.
Yes, all been told.
You see hope where there shouldn't be any. You don't back down, and you don't give up. Talking to you, I almost find myself thinking that maybe we will make it.
You remember that, and keep on fighting even if it looks like there ain't no use. We'll pull through, one way or t'other.
I'm ready.
Preacher made sure everyone was back in position and ready for what was to come. Every gun in the darkened makeshift stronghold was loaded. All the defenders were alert, their eyes turned in the direction the engines would come from. When Preacher was sure he had done everything he could to prepare him for the battle, he drifted back into the shadows.
Coke!
The big dog followed him as he slipped away from the wagons. It would be a few minutes before they noticed he was gone. They might not even tumble to the fact until after the engines launched their attack. By that time, it'd be too late for the defenders to waste any time wondering about his disappearance. They'd be too busy fighting for their lives. Preacher cat-footed along in a low crouch just behind the rise, moving about 75 yards before he dropped to hands and knees and began crawling. Within minutes, his hands and knees were soaked and cold from the snow, but he ignored the discomfort as best he could. Beside him, Dog bellied along, following Preacher's example. Neither of them could afford to be spotted, not until they were good and ready. Preacher stretched out flat as his senses warned him that somebody was moving nearby. Several shapes ghosted past him about 20 yards away. The war party had spread out. Now the engines were closing in. Preacher glanced toward the wagon at the top of the rise, barely able to make out its bulk in the thick darkness. The stars were bright, but what light they gave off seemed to be swallowed up by the heavens before it even reached the earth. It was as dark as the bottom of a well, and as Preacher came up in a crouch again, began to move, he was guided by instinct as much as he was by sight. Smell helped, too. Preacher caught a whiff of bear grease and knew he wasn't far now from the engines. As he came up behind him, he was able to pick them out better, indistinct shapes here and there, dark against the snow. Preacher stood up straight, about 10 feet behind one of the skulking engines, and leveled his Hawken.
Go!
Dog leapt forward, choosing one of the warriors as his prey. Preacher dropped the Hawken and yanked out the brace of pistols.
Open fire! Open fire!
Preacher bounded forward. As a dark shape loomed in front of him, he struck with one of his pistols. Preacher dropped the empty pistol. He reached behind his back and brought up two more and loaded them prime. His thumbs found the hammers and pulled them back as he heard feet rush at him from the side. Preacher pivoted smoothly, bringing up the right-hand gun. Preacher knew the dog was still in the middle of the fracas, pulling down his prey just as his wolf ancestors had done for untold centuries. Preacher just barely ducked the tomahawk as it flew past his head. As the warrior who wielded the hawk stumbled against him, thrown off balance by the miss, Preacher slammed the barrel of the empty pistol across the bridge of his nose. Preacher still had a loaded pistol in his left hand. He needed it as two of the warriors rushed him. The second warrior crashed into Preacher and bore him over backwards. The engine landed on top of him and knocked all the air out of his lungs. Preacher lay there stunned as the Arikara warrior drove the blade of a knife at his throat. The defenders had been taken completely by surprise when Preacher started yelling and shooting from behind the engines. None of them had realized he was gone, but the uproar about 50 yards in front of the wagons gave him something to aim at. Everyone who pressed the trigger of a rifle worried about hitting Preacher, but they fired anyway, knowing that the survival of the entire group depended on winning this fight. The rifle in Roger's hand was empty when he saw one of the engines closing in on him. An arrow clipped the sleeve of Roger's coat as it went past. The warrior dropped his bow and grabbed his tomahawk instead, lunging at Roger with his arm upraised to strike a killing blow. Roger reversed the rifle and leaned in, swinging it like a club. Under the wagon, Jonathan and Angela fired as fast as they could, taking the reloaded rifles that Nate slid up to them. But then, several of the engines were right there in front of him, and Jonathan shoved Angela back as he crawled forward to get in front of her and shield her with his own body. He rammed the barrel of an empty rifle into the belly of an on-rushing warrior. Jonathan reached up and got the engine by the neck. He came to his feet and slammed the man's head against the sideboard of the wagon. Jonathan looked down at the arrow sticking in his side. It hadn't lodged deeply, so he ripped it loose. As another engine lunged at him, Jonathan jammed the arrowhead at the man's left eye. Jonathan saw a couple of the engines run past him and he tried to get in their way, but he was too late. They were heading straight toward the wagon where Jeffrey stood guard over the children.
Jeffrey!
One of the engines leaped to the tailgate. Inside the wagon, Jeffrey dropped the empty pistol and snatched up another one as he crouched beside the rear opening. He was too late. A buckskin-clad figure lunged through the opening and crashed into him. Jeffrey went down. Cold steel bit deep into Jeffrey's belly. The stench of bear grease filled Jeffrey's nostrils, mixed with a coppery smell that he knew came from his own blood. Feeling himself about to pass out, he summoned up the last of his strength and jammed the barrel of the pistol against the engine's cheek. Suddenly, another figure clambered into the wagon. Outside, Preacher watched the warrior's blade descend on his own throat. Suddenly, Dog pulled the warrior over and went to work on him with slashing teeth. Preacher rolled over, came up to his knees, and dove to the side as he saw a tall, powerful figure lunging at him. Swift Arrow came at Preacher, starlight glittering on the knife in one hand and the tomahawk in the other. Preacher leaped to the side to avoid a flurry of slashing blows. Preacher drew his knife from its scabbard. Swift Arrow's knife slashed across Preacher's upper arm, leaving a bloody wound. Preacher struck out with the butt of his pistol. The war chief stumbled but caught himself before Preacher could press the advantage. Preacher's foot suddenly caught on something concealed underneath the snow, and he staggered and went to one knee. Swift Arrow rushed in at him. Preacher went on down, letting the engine's attack go over his head. Preacher bowled forward, knocking Swift Arrow's legs out from under him. Both men rolled away to put some distance between them, then came up to face each other again. Preacher had dropped his pistol, but the tomahawk had slipped out of Swift Arrow's fingers as well. They came together, knives raised. And suddenly, they were locked, motionless, less than a foot apart, each man with the fingers of his free hand wrapped desperately around the wrist of his opponent's knife hand. They strained against each other's grip, putting all their incredible strength into the effort. But for long moments, neither man could budge the other. Then, Swift Arrow's left arm buckled slightly, and the tip of Preacher's blade came nearer the war chief's chest. Swift Arrow's left arm buckled again, and this time there was no holding back the thrust that Preacher made. Preacher shoved hard and felt the steel grate on bone as the blade passed between ribs. Swift Arrow's knees buckled, his hand opened, and he dropped his knife as he sagged. Preacher ripped his knife free and stepped back. Swift Arrow fell to his knee. Then and only then did Preacher realize that there was no more shooting going on. The battle was over. Dog came up to him and nuzzled his hand. He looked around and saw dark shapes sprawled everywhere on the ground. Then he lifted his gaze toward the wagons and saw someone hurrying toward him. His fingers tightened on the handle of the knife. He didn't know if he could fight anymore, but he damn well wasn't going to surrender.
Preacher! Preacher, is that you?
Damn, Silvertip. I'm mighty glad that's you.
Jonathan grabbed Preacher's arm and held him up long enough to get an arm around his waist. Then he began helping Preacher back toward the wagons.
Anybody hurt?
I've got a cut in my side from an arrow, but it's not too bad. Roger and Angela and the children are all right. None of them were hurt. It's a miracle.
Not a miracle. Just hard fighting. Your brother, Jeffrey, old Catamount?
He died protecting the children. I found his body when I climbed into the wagon. The Indian who killed him was lying on top of him with his head blown off.
Oh, hell.
He died fighting like a mountain man. That's another marker you'll have to put up, Preacher.
I'll do it.
At least it's over now. All the engines are dead. All we have to do is make it to Garvey's Fort. We're safe.
That's right. Safe.
That night, about 20 miles to the east, four men rode through the gate in a high wall made of sod and bricks. The wall ran around the compound of several buildings and made up Garvey's Fort, a trading post and one lone bastion of civilization in that part of the country. The riders were lean, hard-faced men. They dismounted and headed straight for the trading post's barroom.
Evening. Anyone here know the whereabouts of a family called Galloway?
Again, they dug a single grave in the morning and laid Jeffrey and Peter to rest side by side in it. Preacher was getting mighty tired of lowering blanket-shrouded shapes into the ground. He figured Garvey's Fort was only about 20 miles away, though, and with the threat of the Arikara War Party taken care of, he hoped they could make it the rest of the way without running into any more trouble. There had been a heap of crying over Jeffrey and Peter. Everybody was dry-eyed again as the wagons rolled eastward later that morning. White clouds floated in the sky, pushed around by a breeze from the south that was still cold, but not as cold as it had been. They would have a few days of better weather before another storm came roaring down out of Canada. And by the time that happened, they would be safe and sound at Garvey's Fort. Angela and Nate each had to drive a wagon now. The young'un was nervous about handling the team, but his pa and his uncle had given him some pointers, and Preacher was confident that Nate would do just fine. The boy had the right stuff. Roger had come through the fight without a scratch, as had Angela. Jonathan had a shallow arrow wound in his side, but Angela had cleaned it and bound it up. With any luck, it would heal just fine. The injury was stiff and sore, but not enough so to prevent Jonathan from driving one of the wagons.
What's eating you, Preacher?
One thing I noticed when I was checking the bodies of the warriors was that Mart Hawley wasn't with them. Now, it could be that Swift Air got tired of him and just killed him. Or maybe Hawley got sick and died from the wound he got during that fight back in the foothills. Or maybe he just plain froze to death. Whatever the hell happened, I hope I've crossed paths with that son of a bitch for the last time.
Hope so, too.
Also kind of feel bad about leaving the bodies of the Arikaras for the scavengers to get. But there weren't no handy gully or ravine where they could be put, and I didn't want to take the time necessary to dig a grave big enough for a dozen corpses. Still bothers me.
Why? They were trying to kill us. I don't see why you'd worry about not burying them.
You've learned a lot about frontier ways, Silvertip, but you still got some things to learn yet. Them old boys were our enemies, sure enough, but they weren't without honor. They were trying to avenge a wrong that was done to their people.
The murder of that young man.
Yeah, that's right. The way they looked at it, they was just after justice. I can't say as I disagree with them.
And yet you helped us. You probably killed more of the Arikara than the rest of us put together.
If they'd gone after just Peter, I might have stayed out of it. But it wasn't right for them to try to kill the rest of you, too. Most of the time in life, there ain't no right or wrong answers. Just shades of good and bad on both sides. You gotta go with which side looks the best.
Most of the time?
Yep. But there's such a thing as pure evil, too. And now and then you do run across it. When you do, you fight it. Simple as that.
I don't think there's anything all that simple about you, Preacher.
Well, you just ain't known me long enough yet.
The temperature remained cold enough to keep the snow from melting very fast, although the sun took care of some of it. The wagons made good time because Preacher kept them moving all day with only short occasional stops. He wanted to cover enough ground today so that they could reach the fort the next day. By nightfall, he was fairly certain that they had. He thought he could have ridden ahead and reached Garvey's place that night, but that would have meant leaving the wagons, and he didn't want to do that. He could wait until the next day and ride in with them. That night, they had a good fire and a hot supper, and although the mood was still solemn because of the losses the group had suffered, there was also talk about what would happen the next day when they reached the fort, and even a mention or two of going on to Oregon in the spring. Preacher sipped from a cup of coffee as he looked across the fire at Roger and Angela, sitting together on a wagon tongue. They had been through a hell of a lot, and while the friendship they shared might or might not blossom into anything else, at least they would always have that friendship. Preacher hoped it stayed strong. Far behind the wagons, Mart Hawley walked along, his feet scuffling in the thin coat of snow on the ground. He saw the faint, distant eye of the fire. He knew the pilgrims were there. He wasn't trying to catch up. The shape he was in, he didn't want another showdown with Preacher. But he had food now, weapons, all scavenged from the bodies of the Arikara war party when he came on them earlier in the day. Yeah, he intended to survive and grow stronger and recover from his wound. And one of these days, when the time was right, his trail would cross Preacher's again. He wouldn't forget, and he sure as hell wouldn't forgive. One of these days, he would have his revenge. The flat terrain meant that the walls of the fort were visible long before the wagons reached them. Preacher, ranging out ahead on the dun, saw them before anyone else and galloped back to tell the others.
Hallelujah!
A short time later, the wagons came in sight of the fort. Preacher couldn't even begin to imagine what a grueling, terrifying journey this had been for the survivors. People inside the fort must have seen them coming because the gates opened and several riders emerged. As they came closer, Preacher recognized one of them as a trapper he knew, Cephas Rattan. Preacher rode ahead of the wagons to meet the group coming out.
Well, howdy, Cephas!
Woo! What you got there, Preacher? You been picking up strays?
I reckon you could say that. Ran into a whole family of pilgrims who thought they could make it over the Rockies with winter coming on.
Rattan shook his head at the sheer damn foolishness of that idea.
I got them turned around and brought them back here. Figured they could try again next spring.
That was smart of you. I'm Fred Garvey. This is my place.
I'm pleased to meet you. These folks behind me are the Galloways.
Galloway?
From Philadelphia?
Yeah, that's where they're from. How in the hell did you boys know that?
Rattan, Garvey, and the other man, who looked like trappers, glanced at each other.
There's some men inside the fort looking for a family named of Galloway that came out here from Philadelphia. They rode in a couple of days ago.
Hard-looking bunch, too.
We told them we didn't know any Galloways. And that was true at the time. They said they'd stock up on supplies and rest their horses for a day or two before they left.
And they're still here?
Still here. They keep to themselves and don't say much. Like Sifa said, they look like hard cases.
I'm obliged for the information. I'll try to find out what it's all about.
Preacher wheeled the dun and rode back to the wagons, about 75 yards behind him. Rattan, Garvey, and the other men trailed behind him. Preacher held up a hand, signaling for Roger to stop. Roger was at the reins of the lead wagon now, with Jonathan bringing up the rear, and Angela and Nate second and third in line, respectively.
Why are we stopping? We're almost at the fort. I can see it right up there.
There's something we better talk about first. Some men at the fort are looking for a family named Galloway. A family from Philadelphia. I don't reckon that's a coincidence, do you?
What sort of men?
A bad sort, according to what I've been told. Now, what's this all about, Roger? Who are these fellas?
I was hoping, we all hoped, that no one would follow us.
The other wagons had stopped behind Roger's, and now Jonathan came forward, carrying a rifle.
What's the holdup? Why aren't we going on into the fort?
There's trouble, Jonathan. Some men are there looking for us.
For us? What in the world for?
Money, I suspect. They've been paid to track us down.
God damn it. Spit it out.
Angela hopped down from the wagon she was driving and came forward, too.
My father paid to outfit us for this trip. But what none of the rest of us knew, except for Peter and myself, was that most of the money was, well, stolen.
Stolen? Simon was a thief?
He took the money from his partner, but only because the man was a thief to start with. He'd been cheating Pa for years. At least, that's what Pa said.
So now this old partner of your Pa's has a grudge against him, and hired men to come out here and look for him. Bounty hunters.
That's what I suspect, yes.
Why didn't you tell the rest of us? Or at least Jeffrey and me?
I suppose Pa was ashamed. I I guess he really was a thief. But he asked Peter and me to keep it to ourselves, and we decided to honor his wishes.
So that's why we had to leave so quickly. Why there was such a hurry about getting out of Philadelphia. Simon wanted to get far away before his crime was discovered.
That's right. Those men who are looking for us, when we tell them that Pa is dead, I suppose they'll go back to where they came from and report to the man who hired them?
Yeah, maybe. It depends on how much vengeance the fellow wants. He may have given him orders to go after the whole bunch of you.
But that's not right. Pa was the one who took the money. The rest of us had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and your brother was the one who shot that Arikara Brave, too. But that didn't stop the Rees from wanting to lift the hair from all of you.
Oh, my God. You mean they may try to murder the rest of us?
I wouldn't put it past them. I could be wrong, though. Only one way to find out.
Roger climbed down from the wagon.
Yes. We'll go in and talk to them.
I'll go in and talk to them. Try to find out just how bad they want you folks.
No, Preacher, that's not fair. You've done so much for us already. We can't ask you to risk your life for us again.
You keep the wagons right here. Don't come on unless me or Cephas here rides out to tell you it's all right. That okay with you, Cephas?
Sure, Preacher.
Now, I can't take sides in this. I've got to do business here.
Yeah, I understand, Garby. We'll settle this amongst ourselves without getting anybody else mixed up in it.
I'm obliged for that.
Preacher lifted the Dunn's reins, but Angela stepped forward and stopped him by laying a hand on the horse's shoulder.
Why are you doing this for us? I'm not sure we deserve it.
Just stay here. I'll be back.
Tan, Garvey, and the other men who had come out from the fort followed Preacher. The gates were still open.
Where are those fellas now?
Last time I seen them, they was in the bar inside the trading post right there. That's where they spent most of the time since they got here.
Preacher swung down from the saddle and looped the reins around the hitching post next to the building's low porch. The trading post had no windows. It was lit by candles and a few lanterns hung on pegs. The air inside was close and stuffy, hazed by smoke, and it smelled of the buffalo chips being burned in a pot-bellied stove in the corner. Even inside, Preacher's breath fogged a little from the cold. The stove didn't do a hell of a lot to ward off the chill. Preacher's instincts helped him recognize the men he was looking for. There were four of them. They sat bunched around a rough-hewn table, a jug of whiskey and four cups in front of them. All of them wore thick coats and high boots. One sported a fur cap, while the others all had floppy-brimmed felt hats, much like the one Preacher wore. The coats were open, and Preacher saw the butts of pistols sticking up behind their belts.
I hear you fellas are looking for a family called Galloway.
That's right.
The words came from the man in the fur cap, who seemed to be the spokesman.
You know where we can find them?
How come you're looking for them?
That's our business. Mike could make it worth your while, though, if you can put us on their trail.
You don't want to go messing with the Galloways. They're pretty good folks. They had a passel of bad luck, and they need to be left alone now.
That sharpened the interest of all four men.
Sure sounds like you know where they are, mister. You'd be well advised to tell us, and then keep your nose out of our business.
Well, never was too good at that. Simon Galloway's dead. He froze to death a few nights ago and is buried about 35 or 40 miles west of here. You go back to the man who hired you and tell him it's all over.
You know the whole story, do you?
Enough of it.
No, you don't know enough. You don't know me. Once I take on a job, I do it. I've been paid to settle up with the Galloways, and that's what I intend to do. That's what we all intend to do.
What about the money? If you get some of it back, is that enough to satisfy you and the man who hired you?
It ain't about the money anymore. Like I said, it's about settling the score.
Well then, you'll have to settle with me first.
Who the hell are you anyway?
Why, mister, that there's Preacher.
Preacher!
Furcap's hand darted toward the gun in his waist as he kicked backward and came up out of his chair.
Get him!
The other three went into action, but Preacher's hands had already swept underneath his coat and closed around the butts of his pistols. Preacher took out the fur cap and one of the others. The two remaining men aimed at Preacher. Unfortunately for them, they both flat out missed. The creature slid across the table and barreled into both men, spreading his arms so he could take them down. Swinging one of the pistols in a short backhanded arc, Preacher split one man's skull. The other man grappled desperately with Preacher, forcing him to drop both pistols. The bounty hunter fumbled at the handle of a heavy-bladed knife sheathed at his waist. Preacher got a hand on the man's wrist just as the knife came free.
Give me.
Preacher pinned the man's arm down and locked the fingers of his other hand around his opponent's throat. Preacher looked around at Garvey, Rattan, and the other men in the trading post.
I'm obliged to you for not mixing in that, boys. It was my fight.
Shit. Didn't figure you really needed the help. Hell, there was only four of them. But t'weren't really your fight, Preacher. You was just taking up for them Galloways.
Well, somebody got to take up for folks what can't take up for themselves. I hate to think what it'll be like in this world if people ever forget how to do that.
That night, Preacher, Roger, and Jonathan sat at a table in the trading post.
Those four bounty hunters are dead. Fella who hired him won't know for a long time, if ever, what happened to him. And if he does find out, by the time he does, you folks ought to be in Oregon, making a new life for yourselves.
You sure you won't guide us there?
Nope, no need. Cephas says he's got a hankering to see the Pacific Ocean. He's a good man, damn near as good as me. He'll get you there just fine.
And what will you do?
I thought I might head south, find some place warmer to spend the winter. There's a place called Texas I ain't never been to yet. It's part of Mexico, but hell, things like that don't mean much to me. Lines on a map only matter as long as a fellow lets them.
We'll miss you, Preacher. We owe you more than we can ever repay. We've learned so much from you.
Well, you're what they call the patriarch of this family now, Silvertip. And you'll do just fine. Take care of each other. That's the main thing.
Preacher looked at Roger.
And you and Angela got kids to raise. You raise them up right.
We will.
Preacher drained the last of the whiskey in the cup in front of him and stood up.
Come next spring, I'll put those markers up.
You're leaving now?
Well, no reason to stay. It's clear night with a big moon. Dog and me can put some miles behind us before we settle down for the night.
But you just got back to civilization.
Yep, and for some of us, that's all the more reason the light is shook.
Preacher shook hands with both of them and left the trading post, walking out into the cold, clear night. Preacher regretted a little bit not saying goodbye to Nate, but he figured the youngster would understand. Nate had some of the same restless nature in him that had always been a part of Preacher. Preacher had already seen that in the boy.
Preacher.
Preacher turned and saw Angela come out of the shadows on the trading post porch.
You're leaving?
Yeah, I reckon it's time.
I hoped you'd spend the winter here, too.
Oh, well, I don't reckon I could do that. Being around people all the time, sleeping with a roof over my head. Some of us just ain't made out for that kind of life. We need to be out in the wild, lonesome places.
You never wanted to stay somewhere? To stay with someone?
Preacher thought of Jenny then, and for a change, he saw her face as clear as day. He saw the smile, a wistful farewell on her lips. And for the last time, he allowed himself to think about what might have been.
Once, maybe. That was a long time ago. You know, Roger's got the makings of a good man. But he needs a good woman. And all those kids. They need mama.
Preacher, I don't know what to say.
Don't say nothing. You just think on it.
Preacher swung up into the saddle.
Yeah.
Preacher galloped out through the open gate into the night.
Come on, dog. Texas is waiting.
First Mountain Man 11, Preacher's Journey, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2005, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Azelford, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, Andy Clements, David Coyne, Karen Carbone, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Kate Torrey, and Michael Replogle. Additional Boot Hill Boys by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Musical score composed and performed by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Preacher's Justice, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Eagles, Blood Bond, and The Last Gunfighter series, available from Graphic Audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator.
Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkin. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkin. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 7, No Good Deed Goes Unpunished.
Motherlode was running as well as it ever had, but it hadn't looked so good in years. Probably since he'd first driven it off the lot more than 10 years ago. After his run-in with a deer in southern Manitoba, the right front fender and much of his front grille had been bashed in. He'd thought about driving it all the way into Toronto so his regular mechanic could fix it, but he'd heard good things about a shop outside of Winnipeg and decided to give them a try. They did the work in a couple of days and had done a great job straightening everything out, matching paint, and polishing the rest of the truck so the new paint wouldn't be that obvious compared to the old. Although he loved his rig and he'd been through all sorts of adventures with Motherlode, she was getting a bit long in the tooth. With the advances that had been made in truck design and engine development, he could probably be driving some computer-monitored wonder machine that would be more fuel-efficient, more comfortable to drive, and safer than what he had now. Mark loved his truck, and there were still plenty of miles, not to mention adventures, still left in her. But that also meant that it might be a good time to sell. Obviously, it was a big decision, and one he'd have to think about over the next few weeks. Mark was traveling east along Highway 11. He'd chosen that route because it was flatter and safer than the shorter but much more twisted Highway 17. This was a big event for the theater troupe, and Mark didn't want to take any chances with their livelihood. The drive was pretty uneventful, until he passed through Moonbeam, a small town on the highway between Kapuskasing and Smooth Rock Falls. Up ahead in the road, Mark saw some commotion on the right-hand shoulder. He slowed his rig to get a better look, and saw a car pulled over onto the side of the road, parked at a funny angle, as if it had been stopped in a hurry, and a man and a woman arguing outside of the car. The woman, blonde and dressed in jeans and a fitted jacket, appeared as if she wanted to get away, but the man wouldn't let her. He pulled on her jacket, yanking her backwards, then poked a finger hard into her shoulder. Mark couldn't let that pass. It didn't matter what they were arguing about. There was no way a guy should be pushing a woman around like that. He pulled over and came to a stop behind the car and got out of his truck.
What's going on? You all right, ma'am?
Hey, get lost, buddy!
He wore a grimy black ball cap, his denim jacket was faded and dirty, his jeans torn at the knees, and his boots had once been black, but they were now scuffed and gray.
Get back in your truck and mind your own goddamn business!
Mark wished he could mind his own business, but he couldn't.
I'm not leaving until I'm sure she's gonna be all right.
She's fine! Now get the hell out of here!
Mark glanced over at the girl, and she was shaking her head.
Would you like to come with me, miss?
She ain't going nowhere! And you're either going away or going down, you nosy son of a bitch!
With this threat, the situation suddenly got more intense. Mark took out his cell phone and dialed 911. Nothing happened.
What the hell?
Mark realized that his phone was out of power, dead.
What's the matter, buddy? Forget to pay your bill?
Mark held the phone up to his ear.
Yes, I'd like to report an assault on a young girl.
As long as Mark acted like the phone was working, the guy might believe that he had called the cops. The ploy worked for about 5 seconds.
Nice try, asshole!
The guy shoved Mark hard. It sent him reeling backwards. He managed to stay on his feet, but only because he'd backed all the way up to Motherlode and was now leaning against her front grille. A truck passed by then, heading east. It didn't slow and honk its horn, and Mark wondered if the driver had even noticed that something wasn't right with this little scene at the side of the road.
You should have been smart like that guy. Stayed in your truck and kept right on going. Instead, you want to be a hero? Sticking your nose in other people's business? Well, now I'm gonna break that nose of yours and a few other bones while I'm at it.
And just then, the girl started to run. Not down the road, but out into the middle of it.
Stop it, both of you!
She was hit squarely by the front end of the car and was sent airborne, flying over the hood, then striking the windshield before rolling off the roof of the car onto the pavement. For a moment, everything was still and quiet, as everyone there on the side of the road looked at the girl for any sign of movement. The girl moved one of her legs slightly, and then lay very, very still. 5 guys, obviously friends of Mark's assailant, piled out of the car.
See what you did? Now we're going to have to make you pay.
You sure you got enough help?
You should have stayed inside your truck, buddy.
My name's not Buddy.
Your name is Mud, asswipe.
Mark ducked the punch easily, but as he was coming back up into his fighter stance, another one of the punks kicked him in the leg. Another punk took a swing at him on the way down. Mark had his hands out in front of him as he hit the ground, but as soon as he was down, there were boots pounding his legs and back.
Son of a bitch.
Mark opened his eyes and saw that 2 of them were standing over him, while the other 3 had gone over to where Motherlode was parked. Each one of them had stones in their hands and were using them against the truck. One of them threw a stone against the driver's door. A rock shattered the left headlight. Mark could handle any amount of abuse to his body, but Motherlode, she was defenseless against these punks. Not only that, she'd been such a valiant road warrior over the years, she deserved more respect than that. Mark got to his feet and ran over to the closest punk and pulled him away from the truck, throwing him to the ground.
What's the matter, buddy? It's just a truck.
Just a truck! That's my livelihood! That's my life! My home! You lowlife sack of shit!
Mark lunged forward, but before he could go anywhere, there were 2 sets of hands on him holding him back.
Or is it just a truck? I bet it hurts you more to see this thing broken than it does for you to get a kick in the nuts.
Mark stood still, showing no emotion. The man kicked in the remaining headlight.
I'm gonna kill you!
Mark tried to break free of the 2 punks holding him. He managed to get away from one, but the other hit him in the back of the head, knocking him to the ground.
I'll tell you what. We'll stop beating the crap out of your truck if you open it up and show us what's inside.
I've got money hidden away in the truck. There's plenty of it. And I'll get it for you if you don't hurt me or my truck anymore.
How much money?
I'm supposed to make this month's bank deposit in Timmins.
Get it.
Mark broke free of the 2 guys holding onto him and stumbled over toward Motherlode. He was able to move better than he'd thought, but he wasn't about to let on to these punks. Right now, he had the element of surprise, and he was intent on keeping it that way. Mark climbed up a step so that he could reach into the cab. But instead of reaching for his money, Mark dug behind his seat for the Louisville Slugger baseball bat he kept there for checking air pressure in his tires and for situations just like this one.
Here it is. I got it right here.
Let me see it. Take it out from behind your back.
Here's your money, you ignorant bastard!
There was another one to his right. Mark changed his grip so that he could swing in the other direction with power. The two punks wanted no part of Mark and backed away, but the other two were standing up to him.
Come on, old man, we're gonna fuck you up!
But there was no way Mark was gonna let that happen. He decided to take on the bigger of the two first, cocking the bat over his right shoulder and moving in for a strike. But the thing was, the punk was looking for a big swing, so Mark kicked him instead, shattering the family jewels. The other one made a move toward Mark, and Mark swung his bat with just his right hand, since that was all his balance would allow. Mark recovered from the swing and set his feet with the bat once more cocked over his shoulder. At that moment, an OPP cruiser arrived on the scene. Because no cars had passed since the truck had gone by, it was obvious it had been a trucker who had called for help.
Put down the bat and get down on the ground!
But they were...
I said put down the bat! Put it down now!
Mark put down the bat. Mark spent the next hour explaining to the police officers investigating the incident just what the hell had happened. He walked them through the entire scene and explained his actions precisely, avoiding any embellishment or drama. When he was done, they thanked him for his cooperation and escorted him into the back of a cruiser.
Can I go now?
Not quite yet. Have a seat and we'll be with you in a little while.
That little while turned into 2 hours as the two punks who hadn't gone to the hospital each explained to the officers what they'd seen. Judging by their body language and exaggerated motions, each of them told quite a different story. Still, from what Mark could discern, it was fairly obvious that they were both telling the police Mark had been the one to start the fight.
Oh, bastard.
There, out on the side of the road, was the second of the two punks acting out the part of Mark, pretending to swing his bat at them all. Then, when it came time to play the part of one of the punks, the kid cowered and shrugged his shoulders, as if he hadn't a clue why Mark would be swinging a bat and trying to hurt any of them. According to the punk's gestures and expressions, Mark must have been some lunatic hopped up on drugs, and they were just six young guys minding their own business. Surely the police didn't think these punks were telling the truth. Mark's story was obviously the one that made the most sense, the one that had all the pieces falling into place. They couldn't possibly take the words of these hooligans over his own.
Could they?
If we proceed with the charges, it looks like it'll be 4 counts of assault with a weapon.
Mark wasn't surprised. While Mark had been able to walk into the police station unaided, 2 of the 4 punks were in the hospital with broken legs and wouldn't be getting out for several days. Another of the punks had a broken arm and 2 broken fingers that required pins to have set correctly, and the 4th one had gotten off lucky with a body covered with bruises that looked like rain clouds.
Hey, I got beaten up too, you know.
I know, and believe me, I'm sorry for the way things are working out for you, but you have to understand our position here. They've got 6 guys all saying roughly the same thing, that you started the fight. That's the word of 6 people against the word of 1. And even though you were roughed up pretty good, your injuries are less severe than theirs, which makes it a little easier to believe that you attacked them and were able to get in your shots before they could do anything about it.
You believe that?
It doesn't matter what I believe, sir. What does matter is the facts. And you were the only one who used a weapon. They might have hit you with their fists and feet, but you had a baseball bat in your hands.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And not one of the 6 of them had a weapon. 6 of them, 1 of me, 6 against 1. Besides, the bat was a weapon of opportunity. I keep it in my truck to check the air pressure in my tires.
Pretty handy thing to have in a fight, though.
What about the girl? She'll be able to tell you I stopped to help her. She was about to be beaten up by the guy with the baseball cap.
She's a key witness, but until she recovers from the hit, we can't proceed based on what we think she might say. The doctor said she might be able to talk well enough in a day or two to give us a statement. If that's the case, This whole thing might be over with by the end of the week.
Well, yeah, the legal stuff might be over. I won't be charged, and that'll be done with. But what about the damage that was done to my truck?
All six of them denied doing a thing to your truck. They all said your truck was like that when you arrived on the scene.
What? And you believe them? I just picked up that truck from a body shop, and I've only put a few hundred clicks on it since I got it back. How can I do all that damage just by driving it?
I can't answer that. What I can tell you is that we're conducting an investigation into what happened, and I'm relating to you what the other party said. We have to weigh that against what you said, and hopefully later against what an independent witness has to say.
I just stopped to help out a young woman who looked to be in trouble. If I knew all this would happen, I would have driven right by and never looked back.
The officer glanced left and right and then closed the door to the room they were sitting in.
Look, sir, we have a pretty good idea about what happened since a few of these guys have been in trouble with this before. But right now, it's six against one. It all hinges on the girl. If she recovers and tells us what she saw, this whole thing might go a lot differently for you.
Great. And what do I do in the meantime?
As long as we have a way of contacting you and you agree to return if we need you to, then you're free to go.
Free to go, just like that.
The officer nodded.
And what about my truck? I don't even know if it still runs or if I can drive it to my destination.
You've got insurance, don't you?
Of course I do. But what am I supposed to do? Put in a claim for the damage? And when they ask me for the police report, it'll say six people swear that I did the damage to the truck myself. I'm sure my insurer will be happy to cover my costs. And of course they won't think of sending my rates through the roof when they renew my policy next year.
The officer said nothing.
Sure, I can afford to stay in town for a few days while my truck gets fixed. That's if they have all the parts and can get to it right away. I'm already going to be late with my load as it is because of all this. You have any idea what all this is going to cost me? On this load, and in terms of future jobs with this shipper?
More silence.
It's going to cost me plenty. All because I wanted to help somebody in trouble. Do you know what kind of message that sends out? Nobody cares. The bad guys can do whatever they want. And it's the regular guy, the hard-working regular guy, who always gets shafted in the end.
The officer's eyes dropped to the floor. Obviously, he wasn't about to get into an argument with Mark, especially when Mark was so much in the right.
Well, I'll tell you something. The next time somebody needs some help out there on the road, it won't be me stopping to lend a hand. Maybe the next sucker will be stupid enough to want to help and screw up his life. Nice guys finish last, you know that? And right now, I'm probably one of the nicest guys you'll ever want to meet. If you don't believe me, just take a look at my truck.
Would you like a ride back to your truck?
Yeah, sure.
This way.
The officer drove Mark to a garage on the highway near Kapuskasing, just a few kilometers east of where the incident had occurred. The road crew had dropped Motherlode off in one corner of the garage's lot, where she sat leaning to one side as if her back, maybe even her spirit, had been broken. The sight of the damaged truck very nearly brought a tear to Mark's eye. Motherlode was a great truck, and had been through countless adventures with Mark, never letting him down and never coming up short. Yet here she was, looking like she'd gone three rounds with a backhoe and a bulldozer instead of just four measly little punks.
Well, it doesn't look too bad.
Mark didn't even bother responding. He'd seen Motherlode at her best, and right now, she looked bad. Her left front tire had lost its air over the past few hours, and that set the whole truck on an angle, off kilter. One of the headlights had been smashed, making her look like she had a black eye. And the mirror framework on the driver's side was twisted as if Mark had gotten too close to a wall. And then there was the paint that had been so shiny just the day before. There were dents and scratches all over Motherlode's body, as if it had been in some kind of catfight with another truck.
Didn't look too bad at all. I'm sure it still runs fine. And after you get that tire changed, you can be on your way.
Shut up!
The cop had been right on one account. It wasn't too bad. It was terrible. A tire change would cost him a couple $100s. A headlight and mirror supports another few hundred. And body work and a paint job, well, it was going to cost him a few $1,000s just to get the truck back to the condition it had been in 24 hours before. Without doubt, it had been the most costly stop Mark had ever made.
Oh, damn it.
It took a mobile tire serviceman 2 hours to arrive and 15 minutes to change Mother Lode's flat tire. When the man was done, Mark thanked him, wrote him a check, and eagerly climbed up into the truck, ready to be on his way. It had been almost 24 hours to the minute that he first stopped by the side of the road, and Mark wanted nothing more than to be on his way so he could leave the whole sorry incident behind him. It was a long and boring drive, giving Mark plenty of time to think. If I'd only kept on driving.
If I'd only minded my own business. If I'd just driven on. I would have made my delivery by now and would be sitting back in some hotel pool enjoying a well-deserved day off. Instead, I'm in a hurry. I'll have to work a week or 10 days without rest to earn enough to get Mother Lode repaired. Damn it!
Up ahead, Mark saw a minivan parked on the side of the highway. There was a woman standing by the vehicle looking at it as if it were some sort of intellectual puzzle. The car obviously had a flat tire, and it was just as obvious that this woman was helpless to do anything about it.
No, you're not gonna do it. She's a licensed driver. She should know how to change a tire. Or else she's married and she can call her husband to come and fix things for her. If not her husband, then the CAA.
Mark paused a moment and his foot unconsciously came off the accelerator.
I've helped one too many people by the roadside. I've done my time for it, learned my lesson.
Mark paused again as he began to have an uneasy feeling in his stomach. It was cold outside and the clouds looked ominous, like it was going to start pouring rain at any moment.
Sorry, lady. Yesterday I would have helped you. Today you're out of...
Mark stopped in mid-sentence as a little girl in a smart summer dress appeared by the woman's side. Then another child appeared, a boy even younger than the first. Finally, Mark noticed the baby inside the van, twisting and turning in his car seat like a fleshy siren set on whale.
Oh, shit!
He just couldn't do it. Mark had to stop and help. It was in his nature, ingrained within him where it would remain until the day he died. Mark began downshifting and pulled to a stop just in front of the minivan.
You need some help?
Oh, yes, thank God.
Mark reached the Elgin Theater in downtown Toronto by 8 p.m. that evening. The stage manager was furious with him for being 2 hours late, but that was a small price to pay. Especially since he had managed to avoid any late penalties by a matter of hours. The stage manager quickly walked up to Mark with a completely outraged look on his face.
What the hell took you so long, eh? You must be driving like a granny out there.
The man paused to look at Mother Lode's condition.
We're a maniac.
Let's just say I ran into some trouble on the road and we'll leave it at that.
A bad boy, eh? You gotta try staying out of trouble, my friend.
Mark bit his tongue to prevent himself from saying anything nasty in return. Then grabbed his paperwork and returned to Mother Lode. Once inside, Mark wondered if he should get the truck fixed or take another load. He needed the money, but he hated driving around in a truck that looked as if it were on its last legs. In the end, he decided to call Bud and see what he had for him.
Hey, Bud.
Dalton, where the hell have you been? I've been trying to get in touch with you all day. Why don't you have your cell phone on?
Mark had shut off his phone, but didn't want to explain it all to Bud.
Must be out of power. Listen, have you got a load for me? I could use a good run.
Yeah, I got a load needs to be in Capscasing by the weekend.
Mark shook his head. He'd just come from there, and considering all the trouble he'd gone through, it was just as well with him if he didn't go back there for at least a few months.
Do you have something else?
Hey, that's the only load I got, and you will be taking it.
Why? What's up?
I've been on the phone most of the day with a man who says he owes you big time.
Who's that?
Elliot Atherton.
Never heard of him.
And he never heard of you until yesterday, when you stopped on the side of the highway and saved his daughter from certain rape by a number of unsavory characters.
That was his daughter, huh?
Yeah, and it just so happens that Elliot Atherton is the CEO of a computer software company.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. And his daughter was able to talk this afternoon, and she told her father and the police all about what you did.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right. And he wants to thank you personally. He knows you're out of pocket, so he wants to reimburse you for all the damage those punks caused to Motherlode and for the penalties you incurred on the late load.
Oh, yeah. Those penalties were pretty steep.
And end, he wants to throw a few bucks your way to do with whatever you want.
Wow.
So, are you going to take the load?
Do I really have to? Can this guy just send me a check or something?
Look, I didn't want to have to tell you this, but there's an article about you in today's Capscasing Northern Times. Seems the mayor wants you back there so the whole town can honor you for what you did. Oh, and you need to be there by Saturday because they got some kind of summer festival going on and they want you to be a special guest for the opening ceremony. You know, key to the city, all that crap.
For one of the few times in his life, Mark was left speechless.
Mark? Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here now. But I'll be in Capscasing by Saturday.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles. Survivalist number 8, The End is Coming. The Last Gunfighter number 5, Showdown. And Outlanders number 14, Hell Rising.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.